Welcome once again to our series of programs on salvation history, the New Testament, the Acts of the Apostles, the Epistles, and the Book of Revelation. This is Chuck Johnson, teacher at John Paul II Catholic High School in Terre Haute, Indiana. Our guest again is Ron Eldred, who teaches history and religion at John Paul II. Ron, let's start by giving a recap from our last session. We did talk about St. Paul in part as being the first of the scriptures written, which of course means he was depending on other sources, and the Gospels as yet weren't even written.
Yes, many of these sources, of course, were eyewitness accounts, which he himself tells us that. But he no doubt, in places we know, he relies on some earlier creeds than, let's say, the Apostles' Creed, or on maybe an earlier catechism or something that was used by the apostles themselves to, instruct people in the faith. But according to Father Arminio, Peter Arminio, who wrote a book called The History of the Catholic Church, only two of Jesus' ethical commands in the gospel tradition also appear in the letters of Paul. We're really now talking about basically the teachings of Jesus as we find them in St. Paul's letters. Keeping in mind now, as you just said, Paul wrote his letters before the gospels were written. So Paul had to get these from somewhere. He had to get them from other sources, from the apostles themselves and other eyewitnesses, of course, to the life and teachings of Jesus. For example, Paul's letters, we find the command to love, Jesus' command to love, and the instruction about divorce and remarriage. The gospel accounts on divorce and remarriage is found in Mark 10 in the Gospels, and on love of neighbor in Mark 12 in the Gospels. The basic requirement to love one's neighbor is affirmed by Paul in Romans 13, in Romans 15, and in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, and Galatians chapter 6. The command to love one's neighbor is specifically identified as the law of Christ. When Paul told the Corinthians that a woman should not separate from her husband, said that it wasn't he who commands this, but Jesus himself who does so. St. Paul affirms in Ephesians 5:31-3, where Jesus quotes Genesis 2:24 and Mark 12:7, that a man leaves his father and his mother and cleaves to his wife and they become one flesh. Paul's quoting this himself. Father Arminio points out the interesting fact that where Paul is reported to have said in Acts 20, verse 35, to a delegation of church leaders from Ephesus to remember the words of the Lord Jesus, that it is more blessed to give than to receive. If this is not found in any other source, within or without New Testament. But the attribution to this saying to Jesus shows how important the tradition of his teachings was for moral instruction within the early Christian communities.
Are there other events that are mentioned about the life of Jesus in the Gospel that are mentioned in other places in the New Testament?
Father Arminio informs us of two other events in the life of Jesus reported in the Gospels that are also mentioned in other New Testament writings, one being the Transfiguration and the other the Eucharist. The Transfiguration is referred to only once in 2 Peter 1, verses 17 and 18. Father says of this passage that the writer of this letter wants to lend authority to what he is communicating by describing himself as one who was present when this event took place. Reference to the Eucharist, or the Last Supper, is found in many places outside the Gospels, all through the letters of St. Paul, many of which we have looked at. It is noteworthy, though, that Paul not only refers to the Last Supper, but also to the words of consecration Jesus spoke on that occasion. And he also claims that this tradition was passed on to him by Jesus himself.
Now, other than the evangelist, Does any other New Testament writer say much about Jesus' miracles?
Neither Paul nor the other New Testament writers, with the notable exception of the author of Acts, which of course is St. Luke, describes any of Jesus' miracles or those of any of his followers. But Paul does refer to healings, signs, and wonders in general as evidence of the Spirit working among his people. For example, in 1 Corinthians 12:9, healing and healers are listed among the leadership roles in the churches. In fact, the ability to perform signs and wonders is one of the signs of an apostle in Paul's writings. The Acts contain many references of the apostles performing healings and wonders comparable to those of Jesus in the gospel tradition, but always as an indication of the continuity between what Jesus had done and what his followers were now doing or enabled to do. Examples are Peter healing a lame man in Acts 3:6, Philip performing exorcism in 8:5-8, Ananias restoring Paul's sight after he was blinded at the time of his conversion on the road to Damascus. Peter healing a paralyzed Aeneas found in the Acts. And Paul healing a lame man and Paul restoring a man to life in Acts 20. A young man who had fallen, if I recall right.
Right. We're about now to undertake a discussion of the early Catholic Church as found in the Bible. To set the stage, let's examine the history of the Roman Empire during the time of the Acts of the Apostles and the early developmental stages of the Church.
Yes, I think it's very important to identify the Church as it's described in the Acts, especially in the Acts, but also in the Gospels and, of course, in the letters of St. Paul. I believe that it was the famous Catholic historian and politician, Lord Acton, a British citizen back in the 19th century, who said in a letter to a Catholic bishop that, quote, power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Great men are almost always bad men, end of quote. Other famous writers or historical persons have said basically the same thing, including the British Prime Minister William Pitt the Elder, the French essayist Alphonse de Lamartine, and even William Shakespeare. Along this line of reasoning, Father Arminio writes in his History of the Church that, quote, power is dangerous. Total power can destroy those who have it, end of quote. Two emperors lived during the time of Christ. Both of them are mentioned, of course, especially in the Gospel of Luke. Caesar Augustus and his stepson Tiberius Caesar. We talk about them when we are in our series on the Gospels. Although the Emperor of Rome possessed absolute power, both Augustus and Tiberius were pretty decent men by the standards of the day, were able to use power without it destroying them. It's true that Tiberius spent the last years of his life surrounded by bodyguards on the island of Capri, engaging in lots of immoral behavior. And Augustus wasn't all that pure when it came to matters of sexuality or whatever. But the Pax Romana, or the Roman peace, was a major contribution made by Rome to the development of Christianity. In other words, the Roman army being, located all over this large part of the world, and for the most part keeping peace and keeping enemies from, invading from outside, what have you. Both emperors kept the peace and order in the empire during their reigns, and Anne Carroll states in her Christ the King, Lord of History, it, quote, this natural unity, lasting hundreds of years, made it much easier for Christianity to spread. If early missionaries had been forced to travel through lands torn by war and strife, their task would have been more difficult, end of quote.
Yeah, I think that observation on the Pax Romana or the Roman peace is very important, providentially even, because also there were the Roman roads. At that point in time, if you had a villa and somebody pillaged it, the troops would get you. Contrast that again to the later period of time when we had castles for protection. The Pax Romana was profound, and it was enforced by an army that would execute anyone that violated Roman law. Furthermore, simply the fact that a Roman citizenship, as Paul had, guaranteed he would be tried only in Rome is remarkable. This was the removal of the law of the rabble, replacing it by a structure that is really quite surprising and impressive in all of history.
That's true.
Well, what happened beyond that point then?
Well, when Tiberius died in 37 AD, he was succeeded by the insane Caligula, son of Tiberius's nephew, an adopted son of Germanicus. He's reported to have once said that he wished the whole world had one neck so that he could cut it off. He was assassinated in 41, after which Claudius was declared emperor by the Praetorian Guard, which was a special bodyguard of the emperor in the Roman army. In many respects, he was a fairly decent ruler. But at 54, he was poisoned from a dish of mushrooms by his hateful wife, Agrippina, whose son, by a previous marriage, was Nero, Claudius' grandnephew and adopted son. Consequently, he became emperor, and Nero was to later have his murderous mother killed himself.
Now, Nero was about as insane as you could get. So we have all these paradoxes going on in Rome. Rome gave us avenues for the apostles and for the faith to move, but it also gave us savage persecution against the Christian community.
It seems to be, you know, a paradox, of course.
That's right.
Or contradiction. And it has been said by historians over the centuries that the enormous power that Nero, just as with Caligula, drove him insane.
Well, he even executed his own teacher.
Yes.
He forced him to commit suicide.
Father Arminio says of him that he was a brutal dictator, an egomaniac, who demanded that he be granted every conceivable honor. In fact, he had a 120-foot high statue of himself erected in the imperial palace. He entered athletic contest, which all the other contenders had to let him win. And then he held huge parties afterwards in celebration of his so-called victories, and commanded the Roman nobility to attend his musical performances to praise his singing. He would compose songs and then sing them, playing the lyre. He also performed as an actor as well as a singer. One source states that he enjoyed driving a one-horse chariot, singing to the lyre in poetry as well. He also composed songs that were performed by other entertainers throughout the empire. At first, Nero only performed for a private audience, but Father Arminio says that in 64 AD, he began singing in public in Neapolis in order to improve his popularity. He also sang at the second Quinquennial Neronia in 65. It was said that Nero craved the attention, but the historians also write that Nero was encouraged to sing and perform in public by the Senate and his inner circle, and even by the people themselves. Ancient historians strongly criticize his choice to perform, calling it shameful. Regarding sports, Nero was convinced to participate in the Olympic Games in 67 in order to improve relations with the Greeks and display Roman dominance over the Greeks. And as a competitor, Nero raced a 10-horse chariot and nearly died after being thrown from it. Though he faltered in his race, in one case dropping out entirely before the end, and acting competitions as well, dropping out of those, he won those crowns nevertheless, and paraded them when he returned to Rome. You know, these laurels, right, you know, that you would right, have and what have you from Greek Olympics. The victories are attributed to Nero bribing the judges, which is probably true, and his status as emperor. In other words, people were afraid to beat him.
Yeah. What'd you say about power corrupts? Power corrupts, absolutely.
Well,
yeah.
I think all of this is enough to consider
yeah,
him a nutcase.
He's a nutcase. Not a basket case unless it's a basket full of nuts. Nero is sometimes remembered as the emperor who, quote, fiddled while Rome burned. What can you tell us about this?
Father Arminio informs us that Nero might have played his harp and sung a poem that he had written while the great fire of July the 18th, the year 64, was burning down half the city, leaving thousands homeless. Rumor had it that he started the fire himself, or had, you know, some of his men started, because he wanted that part of the city to build a new palace and grounds for himself. The destroyed homes were mostly wooden, multi-story buildings. I understand some of them were as high as 8 stories high, inhabited by the poor. He was already extremely unpopular because it was believed that he had murdered his lovely wife, Octavia, so they could marry another woman. So rumor began to circulate around Rome, I guess, that he had had the fire start himself so he could clear that part of the city and build his new palace.
Well, I didn't realize he was that such mischief was afoot. That, I mean, the palace idea, replacing that. So thank you for that.
That's well, actually did build, he built a huge palace and a huge kind of like a swimming pool, acres of of it.
Okay. Now, he must have realized he had better find someone to blame quickly, for that matter, the fire on. Otherwise, people would might even try to overthrow him, which to me, would, given his military power, is not comprehensible. But he had to find somebody to blame it on. What can you tell us about that?
Father Arminio, he informs us that the city was in such a state of confusion and disorder that almost any rumor would be believed. Who better to blame than a group of people professing a new and strange religion, that is, the Christians? At that time, of course, they didn't distinguish Christians from Jews in Rome, because most of the Christians, of course, were Jews.
Were Jews at that point, yeah.
Nero ordered that Christians be arrested and brought to the Circus Maximus, a huge horseshoe-shaped stadium where the emperor staged entertainments such as chariot racing and gladiatorial contests. Father describes how Christians were fed to the wild beast, forced to act the role of characters who were murdered in plays, but the murders were not make-believe. They were soaked with oil, tied to poles, and then set on fire to serve as torches for the emperor's evening parties. The Roman historian Tacitus says of the atrocities inflicted on Christians that they were, quote, covered with the skins of beasts. They were torn by dogs and perished, or were nailed to crosses, or were doomed to the flames and burnt to serve as a nightly illumination when daylight had expired, end of quote. The moral decay of Rome since the days of the Republic were nowhere more evident than in the popular approval given to these hideous spectacles. All this was done to the delight, the bloodthirsty Roman citizenry.
Now, it was during Nero's persecution of the Christians that Saints Peter and Paul were both martyred.
Yes. One tradition has it that they were killed early in the persecution, probably in 64 AD. Another tradition maintains that they were killed later in the persecution of 67 AD. I think that the latter is more probable. whenever it happened, Nero would have ordered his soldiers to seek out and arrest the Christian leaders and bring them to the circus. Father Romano believes that Peter was arrested in 67 and condemned to death by crucifixion to fulfill Jesus' prophecy that Peter would one day stretch out his arms and be led away. Because Peter didn't feel himself worthy to die the same way that his Lord had died, the soldiers granted his request that he be crucified upside down. He was buried nearby, and archaeologists discovered what were believed to be his bones in the early 1950s, deep beneath the high altar in St. Peter's Basilica, where tradition had held that he had been buried. Following the discovery of more bones and an inscription, Pope Paul VI announced on June the 26th, 1968, that the relics of St. Peter had in fact been discovered. John Walsh wrote a book called The Bones of Peter, yeah, which is a fascinating, almost like a reading a detective novel, where he tells that story.
I presume it goes into the archaeology of the steps. Wow.
It was during the pontificate, mostly of Pius the 12th.
Right.
St. Paul was also arrested about the same time. He was martyred in the same year by beheading, the method of death for Roman citizens. His tomb is in the Church of St. Paul outside the walls in Rome on the site of his death.
I didn't realize till now that that was reserved for Roman citizens. It is far more or less barbaric than crucifixion by all means.
Well, several times Paul was saved by being a Roman citizen.
Yeah.
Once when he was, they were going to scourge him, whip him.
Right.
And of course, a Roman citizen could not be whipped in that way. And then, of course, crucifixion was something that a Roman citizen could not have inflicted on him. So he did have the choice to an easier death, having your head chopped off.
At least it's quick.
Yeah, at least it's quick, rather than having to agonize on the cross, for hours and hours.
Okay, now another thing. Nero himself died soon after the fire. Do I have that right?
Yes, he did. In fact, he died the following year in 68 by suicide, as a special division of the Roman army called the Praetorian Guard were about to overtake and kill him. One source says that his increasingly erratic behavior finally cost him all his support for his position. The Roman Senate, the Praetorian Guard, and several prominent army commanders conspired for his removal. When the Senate declared Nero an enemy of the people, that is outside the law, he fled Rome and committed suicide. He's reported to have whispered as he died, "What an artist dies in me."
Oh, wow. Arrogant to the end.
Yes, right.
I'm surprised he didn't sing us a song.
Yeah.
Since Nero had been such a bad ruler, the people would have been happy, or presumably, to have gotten rid of him. Is this true?
Well, it would seem that way, but Tacitus, I wrote a paper on Tacitus in graduate school at the University of Illinois, because we can find quite a bit. He did have some things to say about the Christians and about Christ. He was a Roman historian. He mentions that although the senators, nobility, and upper classes welcomed his death, the lower classes, the slaves, the frequenters of the arena and the theater, and those who were supported by the famous excesses of Nero were upset with the news. Although the Roman army was bribed to overthrow him, they were said to have fixed feelings about this because that is being disloyal to an emperor whom they had taken allegiance. Modern scholars generally hold that well-off individuals welcomed his death, but the general population was loyal to the end and afterwards, so much so that the emperors Otho and Vitellius both thought it worthwhile to appeal to their nostalgia in regarding back to the good Neronian times.
Right.
Well, in other words, during the Roman times, you talk about bread and circuses.
Yeah.
This was a time, of course, when the Romans were beginning to provide the mob with free food and with all kinds of entertainment and things of that sort.
But finally, it was a let them eat cake sort of thing. It was holding them together, and that was about it. What about the year of the four emperors? What happened to the Roman Empire after Nero's death?
Well, the year 69 AD has gone down in history as the year of the four emperors. This is after, of course, that Nero died, after he committed suicide. These four emperors, his name was Galba, Otho was another, Vitalius was another, and Vespasian was the fourth. In one year, all four of these men were emperors. The suicide of Emperor Nero was followed by a brief period of civil war. And from June 68, December 69, Rome witnessed the successive rise and fall of three of these men, till the final accession of Vespasian. Vespasian brought in a new family, the Flavian family.
Oh, okay.
Up to that time, it had been the family of the Caesarian family, you know.
Okay. So now we've really got a substantive change.
You have a new dynasty. Galba, for example, was murdered on January the 15th. Otho committed suicide after being defeated in battle on April the 19th, and Vitellius was slain in the streets of Rome on December the 30th. One source states that this period of civil war has been emblematic of the cyclic political disturbances in the history of the Roman Empire. The military and political anarchy created by this civil war had serious repercussions, such as the outbreak of the Batavian Rebellion. And finally came Vespasian, who was the only Roman emperor between 37 and 96 AD who is known for certain to have died a natural death. It was said of him that he was a practical man who was not greedy for power, and he ruled well for 10 years and did not persecute Christians. During Vespasian's reign, the Jews in Palestine rebelled against the Romans, which was to have monumental consequences for the Christians. And during our next session, we're going to begin to take a look at these Jewish wars that took place during the first century that had such repercussions on the whole world and, of course, upon Christianity.
So I presume we'll be discussing Josephus.
Yes.
And the hideous destruction of Jerusalem.
Yes.
Yeah, this itself is extremely important for Christianity, because at that point, the sect which was thought, which Christianity was perceived as within Jewry, had to exit, because when they went to Jamnia to found a new place with not the Christians but the Jews, there was no room for dissent at that time, and this drove Christianity out into the world. Okay, once again, we've run out of time. We'll be back again with our next session. Thank you.
Thank you.